Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for all things Kings of War. Join your hosts, Mark Zielinski, Jeremy Duval, and Rob Phaneuf as they delve into the world of Mantica and bring you in-depth coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge. I'm Ray Shields.
And I'm Rob Phaneuf. Ray, how are you doing tonight?
Rob, I'm doing excellent tonight. Thank you very much for having me. And historicals are an issue that's near and dear to my heart.
We had talked a little bit offline. You know, historicals in general is not a topic we talk enough about. And I think there's a lot of people out there that would enjoy playing historical armies. Maybe not all the time, but from time to time.
From time to time, they make a nice change from your elves and dwarfs and undead to playing something different. And it's also a way to get other people who you can see in a hobby shop from time to time who are playing those historical games to transition over and to try something else new in Kings of War.
Let's talk about what have you been doing on the hobby side. I know you're working on a new army.
That's right. I'm currently working on a Forces of Abyss army. It's going to be a completely Mantic army. I am not going to be able to make it to Adepticon, but I figured I should do my best to create a fully Mantic army and transition away from the old world. I'm going to do them in traditional red and white colors, so all the Forces of Abyss are going to be red with some wonderful snow bases, which will remind me of back home in Canada.
For those who don't know, where in Canada are you from?
I'm from Ontario. Last place I lived was Ottawa, and I think the next place I live when I eventually leave the States to get posted back home will be back to Kingston, Ottawa area in Ontario.
Well, you're Abyssals. What made you want to just make an all-Mantic army?
To date, I've been doing armies which I had from Warhammer Fantasy, but never actually played in Warhammer Fantasy. So back in 8th edition and 7th edition, the army I played with was Bretonians, which transitioned really well into historicals. But I had bought the models to play Skaven, I had bought the models to play Ogres, but I actually never played with the armies before the world collapsed. And so all of a sudden Mantic came and they're like, here, you have the option of playing with all these armies and models. And I'm like, sweet, I get to use these models for the first time in my life, which I had spent money on clearly back 5-10 years ago. And so I've been painting them up, and I painted up the Ratkin, and I painted up the Ogres. And now it's like, okay, it's time to buy a new army, and I want to support the hobby that I've come to play and love. And so I bought the Forces of the Abyss, and I'm slowly working them up and painting them up.
And what attracted you to the Abyssal army?
Probably because it's a fairly full range at this point in time where I can do the whole army in Mantic. Part of me wanted to do Forces of Nature, but I'm not the greatest modeler and converter. So doing some of the more interesting and unique elements, I'd fail at. I know my limitations. Whereas with Forces of the Abyss, I can get the models, I can have it represented on the field. It's all Mantic, and life is pretty good.
That Cronius model is amazing. I gotta figure out a way to get it into one of my armies.
He is, and if I was going to, I'd love to use him as a fire elemental as well. Like, I think he works across multiple armies. I haven't seen him used that way. I also like the lower Abyssals, to be honest. I've just constructed 90 of them. I might be using a couple of hordes of lower Abyssals in my planned army. But they're solid plastic infantry to work with, and I look forward to seeing them on the battlefield.
Do you have a timetable of when you'll think you'll have them complete? Is there like an event? Are we going to see them at Mountaineer next year?
Oh, they'll definitely be done around then. Probably April timeline, Vanguard maybe.
The last weekend of April, right?
Last weekend of April, same weekend as Lone Wolf. It's occurring April 28th, 29th. Whether they're done then or if I can manage to get them done and go up to War Kings in Ohio, I'm not sure which one it'll make.
What events do you have on your schedule for next year?
The first event I have on my schedule is Siege of Augusta, being run by Robert Brandon. That one's coming up in January. For anyone who's interested, if you sign up now, you can get brought into draws for the event. Robert's giving out $30 Mantic gift cards at the end of each month. So that's the big event in January. It's being used as a Masters prep. And then in February, I have the pleasure of going to Masters down in San Antonio. Really looking forward to that. I traveled down there for Alamo a couple weekends ago, and I had an absolute blast with Mark Cox and Ryan and Jeffrey Swan and Luke and all my opponents. I actually got to see Jeremy for the first time and have a game with him in my first game. And all my opponents were absolutely lovely. It was a great time. 5 good games, probably a bit too much beer, but it was a great weekend.
Bummer you're going to miss Adepticon, but you know, you travel to quite a few events, so I think we can excuse you for one event.
My wife has a concert that she wanted to go to, and we've already bought the tickets. And when I looked at the weekends, it's like, you know, I do get to go to a lot of tournaments, and she's been gracious enough to let me fly and travel. So I can't say no when she's...
On our end, we are planning for Blue Cedar Brawl next year, April...
13th, 14th of April. I'm still trying to finagle that one. That one's currently in a contention with my wife planning a cruise. So I'm not sure which one's going to win, Rob, but if I do get to come down, it will be me and my dad. I am completely looking forward to Blue City Brawl. I have heard nothing but great things from Jake Hutton about it and their team dancing their way across the United States.
Absolutely. Their interpretive dance last year was quite fun. So we're super excited about that coming up. Obviously, Adepticon, there's a lot of folks getting excited about Adepticon. It's got a lot of buzz for next year. We're definitely going to smash. I think they had 26 players last year. I mean, I know of at least 40 people coming. So they better up the attendance. They have a maximum slot of 30 right now. That's definitely not going to be enough. So if you're listening, Mantic, make sure you do that. When you're hearing this, Westphalia Miniatures has their newest Kickstarter up for Feral Elves. Make sure to check that one out. Yeah, I guess that's about it for me. Let's dive in. Let's talk about some historical armies.
So as much as I talked about how I used to play Warhammer, actually my first love from being a little child was actually historicals. So ever since as long as I can remember playing historical games with my dad, with my family, with my friends growing up. DBA, DBM, 100 Years War, the war between the English and French was actually the very first army that I ever got. Somehow I managed to convince my mom when I was about 8 years old to buy me an army of models so I could paint and put together. And I still have them 25 years later. So I absolutely love historicals. Growing up, going away, you know, you could find people to play fantasy games, so I transitioned to that. But when I came into Kings of War and when I found out about the fact that Kings of War has this historical supplement, it was an easy purchase. It was, wow, okay, there's this historical army list. I can buy it. I can use my armies. I can play across with Kings of War. I can play Egyptians versus versus the undead. I can play the French versus Varanger. I can play as my Saxons and Vikings in a historical battle. It was just, it was a no-brainer. Absolutely not. And looking at the work, it's a quality book. It comes with all the things that you would expect from Mantic, with the same layout of rules, very simple to follow, easygoing, and then with all the different army lists that you could expect. So it has everything in there that you need to play the game, and it provides an easy transition from historical games into fantasy through the inclusion of mythical units. So I guess to tone back my excitement for a little bit, to give an overview of the book, like I said, it's a Mantic book. So it follows the same I go, you go format that we know and love from Kings of War. You move, you shoot, you fight, you test nerve. All of that would be extremely similar to anyone who's read the Kings of War rule booklet, which is why I said it's very easy to go from one to the other. There are a couple of key differences, though, that I'd like to identify for people in case you ever play a historical army or in case you're interested in starting a historical army, just so that you're aware of what the differences are if you see them on the battlefield. To begin with, the biggest one is actually probably skirmishers. Skirmishers are something that's important to historical armies because you always think of the blocks of pike or the Roman legions cohorts moving forward with their skirmishers out in front with bows and arrows or slings or javelins going forward to fight. And to kind of demonstrate that rule in Kings of War, in historicals, they treat skirmishers as individuals. So they're allowed the free pivot at the start of the movement, the nimble. The question as to whether or not they have unit strength is actually an issue that's still being treated individually by various tournaments. I think the current ruling in the Southeast is that skirmishers do not have unit strength, which makes it exceptionally hard for them to win games, such as Invade.
Almost impossible for some of the scenarios.
So if you have armies of skirmishers, that becomes, there's a chance for them to be considered overpowered in armies such as the Mongols and Huns. If you have skirmishers in something like a Greek army, where they're just in front of your phalanxes and your models with spears, they're not really an issue. So that's one of the ones where I remember asking on Fanatics is to, or Kings of War Worldwide, how should we treat skirmishers, whether they're without unit strength or whether they're toned down to just being nimble units with stealthy, is probably one of those things that I'd like to see clarified in FAQ going ahead to make it easier for them to transition from fantasy to historicals and vice versa.
With your background, do you kind of have an opinion on which it should be?
I like the simplicity of Kings of War and that removes a lot of the ambiguity for fighting. I think if you treated the Mongols and skirmishers as nimble and stealthy, I think that would do everything it needs to do. And then they would have unit strength. So a regiment of cavalry would be unit strength one. You could actually trap them. You could bring them to fight eventually. It'd be hard because it's still nimble cavalry. But I think that's the way I would go.
That's sensible.
And nimble and stealthy is a great combination going ahead. So it would still let the infantry go ahead and screen the other infantry. They would block shooting against the main pike blocks, which when you think about them in the Roman list and the Greek list, that's what skirmishers are supposed to do. They're supposed to go forward, engage the other shooters, and stop anyone from hitting the phalanxes and the legions before they're ready to engage. So treating them as individuals, they don't actually provide cover. Whereas if you treat them as a formed unit that has stealthy and nimble, they do the historical role of providing cover for the main bodies behind them. So that's my plug for a change to skirmishers, if anyone's listening.
Everybody's listening to Ray. You didn't know? They knew you were on, and they're everybody's listening to this episode.
Other changes are shooting. The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune and fate. May they smile upon me at Masters. But in the meantime, in historicals, you can definitely have your slings and arrows. And I'm considering a Saxon army with a couple of regiments of slingers, and they have 30 inches of range. And some of the early rifles, arquebuses, have 18 inches of range. So there are a few other shooting things that are a bit different, but nothing outstanding in the shooting world. Dread is one of those things that has actually transported from historical over to fantasy. And the difference is in historical, you have key figures who, over periods of time, cause dread in their opponents or caused fear. And what it does in historicals is actually does not allow the inspiring reroll. So it's a quite a powerful special rule. And examples of people in the historical list who have this are Genghis Khan, because obviously he caused lots of people to be fearful of him, but also the Black Prince. And I said I loved the Hundred Years' War. One of the interesting stories is later on in his career as the Black Prince, he became enfeebled as an older man, and he got sick. So they actually had to carry him around in a litter to battle. And even as he's carried around in a litter to battle, the French were so fearful of his generalship and his abilities that they refused to fight him. Even if they outnumbered the English army, they refused to fight him. And that's demonstrated by Dredd saying, no inspiring rerolls. So that's quite powerful. Not a lot of people in historicals have it, but just something to be aware of. Hills are something that only matters in a historical versus historical game, whereas in fantasy it provides a height advantage and is very good for shooting. It provides a bit more of a defensive bonus in the historical game because if you're attacking uphill, you're hindered, whereas if you're charging downhill, you're fine. So that's something in historical games and historical tournaments, if you ever play one, to be aware of because it changes how you use hills a little bit more. And finally, the other major change I'd like to discuss is the special rule, and I'm going to screw this up, but Fulcon, it's the negative to piercing attacks. So Typically, you'll see it most often in the Romans, which is why they're a very popular historical army to bring over to Kings of War, is they have the ability to be -2 for piercing. So where they're defense 5 or defense 4, they're defense 6 against shooting. So kind of like Big Shield, but only for shooting. So if you're planning to go up against an elf list and you have the option of bringing the Romans, it's probably not a bad idea.
So going back to hills for a minute, though, have you tried hills in the context of a fantasy game? And that hill rule, is it, you know, that's been one of the kind of the, it's been a divisive topic of conversation from time to time, because it does give the, especially a shooting unit on top of the hill, such an advantage. But kind of give us a little bit more background on the hill rule.
Well, when you think of important battles in history, whether it's the Battle of Hastings is the first one that comes to mind, the Battle of Agincourt, I'm forgetting the battle between Alexander Great and the Persians when he crossed into Turkey and he's fighting the Greek hoplites, and his phalanxes are not able to deal with the hoplites because they're charging uphill. So historically, whenever armies, be it the Normans, the French, even Alexander the Great, going uphill was something that was difficult, something that would cause your charge to lose momentum and be something that would make it harder to actually win the day and carry it off. Now, in all of those battles, I think the people charging uphill still won, so except for Agincourt, but at Hastings, the Normans still won, and Alexander the Great still won, but they won due to generalship, and they were hindered by the hills. So having the hills actually hinder a force is historical. Given the benefit that it gives to shooting in Kings of War fantasy, I'm not sure it would be a good rule to import. I think it would make an elf horde on a hill or a horde of chariots on a hill that much more powerful and that much harder to dislodge. So as much as I can see the historical reasons for it, I think given the benefits it provides to shooting, it's not something I would champion for to bring over. I have seen in tournaments where historical armies that come into a tournament, their special rule per se is that they treat hills as causing hindered if you charge up against them. I have seen that done where it's a benefit for historical armies and no one else, but it's not something I'd like to see for fantasy.
Generally speaking, do you find the historical armies, when you compare them to their fantasy counterparts, are they underpowered?
Well, that's actually really an interesting question, because I don't think that they're top tier, but I don't think that they're a lower tier list. I think I can go with a historical army. I have gone with a historical army, and I can definitely go 500 in a tournament. I think that there are some historical armies that transition better to Kings of War fantasy than others. But what I like about it is it gives the Kingdoms of Men list a bit of variety and a lot of choice. So if I think about it as being a Kingdoms of Men list, which is really what the book gives you. It's all the options and kingdoms of men, all pointed out with chariots and elephants and phalanxes and berserkers, the works. And then you take that, and for every army that you have, whether it's barbarians or Indians or Persians or Thracians, you get to limited on the options that you can pick. So the French can't necessarily pick bowmen. The Scottish can't necessarily pick knights. And so you don't necessarily have the full Kingdoms of Men list, which is provided by the master list. But what you get instead is you get a historical element, something that's unique. For the Vikings, you get the Berserker at Stamford Bridge. And he's this amazing little character who fought at the Battle of Stamford Bridge. And he held up the Saxons to allow the Vikings to form their lines. And his special rule, besides being awesome, is that he gets 7 attacks. But if he's the only one fighting a regiment or horde, he doubles his attacks. So every list has something that's pretty cool. And the Vikings have a legion of berserkers. The French get their amazing French knights, Chevalier. which are elite and headstrong, and because the French knights were the best in the Middle Ages. The English get the longbows. The Ottomans get the janissaries. So you get something that's unique to your historical list. And I think if you use that, you can definitely compete in the fantasy tournaments. I'm not sure if you can win in the fantasy tournaments, but you can definitely compete and make a good showing for yourself. And so I would have no issues. I had no issues the three times I brought fantasy armies to tournaments. I competed with varying degrees of success. And it's something that I will definitely do again in the upcoming year because it's fun, it's different. It's something that's normally fairly unique at a tournament. Even something like TNT, I think you only saw two historical armies in a tournament with nearly 60 people. So it's something that's very cool, very unique. And sometimes you have the models and you just want to bring them out.
Why do you think that is, that there was only, you know, it was open, you could bring them? Why do you think there was only the two?
Well,
is it the perceived weak, or?
I think it's perceived weakness. I think it's unfamiliarity. And it's something that I'd like to just tell everyone that if they have the army, that they should give it a shot. Because you can play Kingdoms of Men, or you can play as the Spartans. And you can pretend to have your 300 holding the pass. You know, that's what, six hordes? Seven hordes and some support, and you can be there and hold the pass. You know, you can do what you want and have a fun game, have a themed game. We're pushing models. Hopefully you have a couple drinks during the time, and it makes for a really fun game. So there were probably more historical lists than there were orcs at TNT, so.
That's a good point.
It wasn't completely absent, but it's not something that's very common because normally Kings of War is always advertised as a fantasy tournament or advertised as a fantasy outing. And to say, here, we're going to allow historicals and we're going to even encourage historicals or make it clear, is not always done. Some tournaments flat out say that you're not allowed to bring historical armies and that you must pick from the 21 armies in Kings of War.
Why do you think that is? That I know for me personally, you know, we have not allowed them at Blue Sea Brawl. But why do you think that is? The tournament organizers don't open the book and say, yeah, bring them.
I think there's a couple of reasons. I think the first reason off the start would be that they're worried that not everyone's familiar with the historical armies. So this is a bit of a social contract. I show up to the game, you show up to the game. In Kings of War especially, it's great. You know, we pass each other the list. We know what each other's units do. Life is good. And we have that social contract for a good game. And I think there's the fear that if you're bringing historicals, not everyone has bought the historical book. Not everyone understands the special rules, be it shooting, dread, folklorn, or skirmishers, and that there might be surprises. So I think it's the element of surprise that tournament organizers are kind of fearful to introduce, and to be fair, with a bit of reason. But especially in the Southeast, they're very common. Northeast, it's a bit less common, and Mid-Atlantic is allowing historical armies. So I think you're seeing it spreading as people become used to historical armies being played. And as people have good experiences fighting them, how can you have a bad game against Tony Nelson? And I think he's currently right. Working on Macedonians at this time, and he's trying to figure out how to get his Alexander the Great and companions to work. So I don't know if he's going to bring those down to Siege of Augusta. He might, but it would be interesting to see.
In the context of historical games, kind of where do you put Kings of War historicals in that scale between historical accuracy and cinematic flair of the army, if that makes sense?
It does. I would say that Kings of War historicals is... I had somebody talk to me about the differences in the Roman legions and how the list doesn't fully represent what the Romans, how the Romans fought and how they... And you can't. It's a D6 game, 3+ to 6+ for fighting, 2+ to 6+ for defense. There's only so much change you can do. I consider it a bit more than DBA, To anyone who's ever played that, that's where you have 12 units and each one gets to move, shoot, and fight. And the onus is really on you as an individual to provide that historical flair if you want. So when I'm playing as the French, I want to make sure that my French army looks and feels like a French army. I want to have my knights. I want to have my infantry on foot. And ideally, I'd love to figure out how to put crossbows in the list. I didn't, but I probably should. When I'm playing with the English, I want to make sure I have lots of longbowmen because historically that's what they had. But could I make an English list that has no longbowmen in them fighting the Hundred Years' War? Absolutely. Could you make a Roman list with no legionnaires? Yes, you can. The onus is on the individual to add the historical flair, to add the historical accuracy when they make their list. It's not forced upon them by the list, which is, I guess, a good thing at the end of the day because it gives you more options to play with. It also, if you're taking these to a fantasy tournament, you're often allowed to bring mythical allies, which I always thought of as a great way to bring the crossover as you're working on your fantasy army. So you can have your historical army, you can have your Romans fighting alongside a horde of ogres, or fighting alongside a horde of Alohi, which could be all dressed up as Roman gods that you could fight with. Or in my case, I have Joan of Arc alongside the angels. I'm using Ur Alohi as the angel Gabriel coming down to talk to her because the angels talked to her. That's how she knew the history. So it's up to you what you want to do and how you want to do it, which is the great thing about the list and the armies.
Your comment there kind of makes me think, you know, on one hand, I wonder if this is mutually exclusive, making armies that are more historically flavorful versus competitive, right? I wonder if they left it open so that you have that choice to, because like you said, you know, the English probably should have longbowmen, right? They should, but maybe there's a scenario in which, you know, from a competitive standpoint in a tournament, maybe you don't want the longbow. I wonder, that's just a question I wonder is how, there's a scale obviously between historical accuracy and the competitiveness in the army, and I wonder if sometimes they are mutually exclusive or if there's overlap.
I would say it does a good job of giving the feel without getting bogged in the details. And so if I was going to do this and I was going to build a Roman list, I can absolutely do that. But if I'm playing a Roman, Rome was around for an extremely long period of time. We're talking 700 BC to 480 onwards. The Byzantine Empire was around for 1,000 years, and trying to represent 1,000 years of military history in a single list is extremely hard. I don't think anyone can do it. So what they've done is they said, here are the units you can use as Rome. You have everything from heavy infantry to light infantry to skirmishers. You know, we're giving you the legions as your special unit. Because we want that kind of feel if you're playing as the Romans, go forth and make a list. So I think they gave you the options to be historically accurate if you take them. And to be fair, I think a historical Roman army is actually fairly powerful if you take them that way. So I'm happy with it. I'm happy with how my English looked on the field. I'm happy with how my French looked on the field. It felt historical. I played many games, and I've never felt like my English longbowmen fought the way I read in the history books. But spoiler alert, I've taken the English longbowmen to a tournament. They were awesome. They have elite, ensnare, piercing one, reload, and they melee on 4+. I don't think any bowman, no other bowman in Kings of War, I think, melees on 4+. They range 5+. So historically, you read about these longbowmen fighting in combat against the knights, against the French knights. And within snare and melee 4+, you have that feeling, plus elite, that they could actually do it, that they're not going to get run over if somebody tries to charge them. So
absolutely,
they're a historical feeling unit. The same with the French knights. They're elite, headstrong, they're heavy cavalry. They feel like French knights. So I think they gave you the feeling. And that's really what I want for the 2 hours when I'm playing a game.
A lot of other games have put these army lists on the table, whether it was DBA or Warhammer Historical. But the reality is that a lot of those other game systems had very specific lists where they would break up the Romans into all these different lists, you know, or the successor kingdoms of Macedonia, you know, so it's sort of like they in one way, this is a great way to do it because they're giving you all the tools and they're just putting the onus on you. If you want it to be historically accurate, then it's on you to do that.
Absolutely. And they're trying to encourage you to play at that time and place. Because even the Spartans over the course of the Peloponnesian War, the amount of armor that they wear in the course of those 30 years decreases because they want to be able to move faster. And how do you represent that in something like Kings of War? I don't actually know. But you as a player, you know that. You have your Spartans. They're playing. You can dress them up. You can paint the models. You can buy whatever models you want to represent whatever period. And you know what you're bringing. And they'll play like Spartans.
What about modeling? I mean, obviously you've got two pretty armies, probably two of many armies that you've got, but you know, maybe take your English. What model range did you use?
I'm actually kind of cheekish about this one. I pulled my English from the Bretonians way back when I had a lot of Bretonian archers because I thought that you could play with them in Warhammer 7th and 8th, and then because I wanted to build the English army. Yeah, that didn't. They weren't very good,
They do look very English. Let's be honest. The Warhammer Bretonian army bowmen. You're talking about like the 7th edition, the latest edition kit. They look like peasant bowmen. I mean, they're awesome.
So I had them, and I came over and I looked at the Brotherhood list. But in the Brotherhood list, they're melee 6+. They have phalanx, but they're defense 3, so it doesn't really help out a lot. And they don't fight like 100 Years' War archers, which is why I was super excited to play them as the English army. I currently am working on a Saxon army and probably a Norman army after that. And I'm getting them from Warlord Games, which does 28mm figures. They have them all in plastic. There's the Perry miniatures, which I'm currently redoing some dismounted French knights from. The Perry brothers do an extensive historical range across all different genres and time periods. So there are a ton of modeling opportunities in historicals. They've been around since at least the 70s, and they continue to get developed. Oftentimes, you can find them in hard plastic, and you can pick whether it's samurais or janissaries. And because it's coming from the historical community, be it Essex miniatures or what have you, the options are out of this world. Like, you have every single unit, and you can get the different types of Greeks from the different periods in hoplite warfare just by looking at it, because they have all the different ranges to support.
War Games Foundry, Warlord, Victrix. I mean, there's just a ton of hard plastic and metal. If you want to go metal, there's tons of metal as well.
And really, the issue I'm coming to is I can't paint as much as what I can buy, so sometimes keeps piling up is my issue.
The real beautiful thing about historicals in general is there's always going to be a historical game. So it's not like, you know, you build a Warhammer army and then Warhammer dies and you got to find another game to play with it. If you build a Greek army, you may have to rebase it, but there's going to be games that have Greek armies in it in perpetuity.
Absolutely. And there's Shield Wall and there's Saga. And so you have the skirmish games that feed into the larger games. And there's always people who play exactly what you said. There are people who play historicals. Sometimes they're a bit harder to find, but it's one of those hobbies where you build a historical army, you bring it over, and you just try to show off that I'm playing this historical game. And you talk to the people. I saw that Siege of Augusta when I went down there, and it takes place at a historical tournament, and you can walk around, and whether it's bolt action or historicals or naval, you can talk to the people about the games that they're putting on. And if you build yourself a Greek army and build yourself a Persian army, you'll always be able to play those games with others and find a set of rules.
You know, I was just thinking, I think what Kings of War Historical does really well is it makes a historical game very accessible. Because, I mean, in the past, I've played other games, and they were so intimidating. You know, you get out your DBA book, and there's all these little minutiae, or you get a Warhammer supplement, you know, Warhammer Historical, and then there's this supplement, and this is all in one book.
And I prefer the King. I have the Warhammer supplement and Warhammer Ancients. I prefer the Kings of War because I think it demonstrates how the armies fight better than that one. But you're absolutely right. If you went into the old school WRG 7th edition, 6th edition, you have all the tables. Like, I have this many ranks of pike. I'm in this order. I'm this morale grade. No. Kings of War gets rid of all that. You have your nerve. You have your capabilities, and you just do the battle. And I think one of the things it does is it makes it accessible. So I'm going to be bringing this down for Thanksgiving to my dad's house. We're going to pull out his Ancients. We're going to have a Successors War battle, him versus me, using Kings of War historicals, and we're going to give it a go. And I'm going to teach him the mechanics of the game using his historical models and this set of rules.
Absolutely. We actually, at an event a couple years ago, a gentleman, Gavin, he wrote a set of, he took Kings of War and he basically modified it for English Civil War. And so, you know, the rule set can be adapted very easily.
And I've heard of them being adapted as well for Napoleonic. So I'd love to see that. But it's one of those, it's a great set of rules. It's robust. It hasn't been broken, despite the best efforts of many people to try to figure out how to get it to their work to their advantage. And you know, like I said, I've gone to a lot of tournaments this year, and it's hard for me. I can't remember having a bad game. The game's always good. The community's great. You can bring these armies, and you can show other people your passion as to why you want to play the English or why you want to play the French. And you can share that passion with others. And it's a really an accepting community, an exceptional community for that reason.
Before we get into talking about your specific armies, you had mentioned Mongols and Huns as maybe a pair of armies that have some issues.
If I had a choice, I would say to watch out, because those two armies are dependent upon their skirmisher units. The Mongolian cavalry skirmish and the Hun cavalry skirmish. And it's vital to the way that their army works. And it's with the problems with unit strength, it's one of those ones where they're hard to win scenarios. Not a lot of people are used to them. I think you could take every other army in the book, and most people would be like, okay, that's a phalanx. Those are warriors. Those are berserkers. I know what it does. Those are the two armies that I've heard of causing issues because they depend upon the skirmish units for their army. Their army is composed of skirmishers, and because they're individuals, that makes it really hard. So if you're hesitant to say, I'm going to allow historicals into my tournament, I would say let them, and I'd say put an asterisk next to Mongols and Huns and say, you know, if you want to bring these, let's have a conversation. And then you can do what we talked about earlier, say, okay, they're going to be nimble and stealthy instead of skirmishers, check, or what have you, because those are the only two armies I've heard of having issues. And I think those are the only two armies that people have brought up in the forums as being one to watch. And it's because no one else moves like them. No one else has an army comprised of individuals. They have been used to great success, but I haven't heard of anyone actually winning a tournament with the Mongols or Huns to date either.
Very difficult to win if, you know, if they don't have...
If you have no unit strength.
Yeah, it's very difficult to win a scenario. Mm-hmm.
If you're playing a Mongol and Hun army and somebody only has a unit of ogres and maybe another unit with unit strength, if you kill those two, it's going to be a draw. You might lose your entire army, but it'll be a draw.
Well, let's get in. What we're really here to talk about tonight is you've had some pretty good success running these armies in fantasy events.
Yes, I had the pleasure. I was fortunate enough to qualify for early to be able to go down to San Antonio, which I'm really excited for. And I got to pull up the historical armies, which are my love. And the first one was at Mountaineer. I got to play at Mountaineer with my English army. I designed it to be what I thought of as a traditional 100 Years' War English army. That being said, I have been afraid to go into an army, into a tournament, without mythical allies and mythical aids. So I haven't fully embraced the only historicals at this point in time. I'm still debating how I could do that successfully. With the French, I might be able to. With English, I need Banechant. So I have two regiments of heavy warriors on foot. Those are supposed to be, in my mind, like the men-at-arms who were dismounted in between the longbowmen. They have an additional crushing one strength at the expense of the defense. I have heavy cavalry, 2 regiments, 2 generals, very inspiring, just traditional kingdoms of men individuals, 2 musicians. The musicians are a really key part in historicals because they provide rally too. So all of a sudden, your heavy warrior foot regiment, instead of being 14, 16, is 16, 18. And that additional bump of 2 nerve is something that sometimes people get caught off guard on. Not in a bad way, because you're not surprising them. It's just, oh, wow, it takes that much more to break a unit that's 16, 18 instead of 14, 16. I then went with 2 regiments of longbowmen, 2 hordes of longbowmen, because that was why I brought this army. 2 heroes on winged beast, which is essentially heroes on a Pegasus, 90 points, and then 2 wizards with Banechant. So I brought that army out to Mountaineer. I think I went straight 500, 2 wins, 2 losses, and a draw. The most difficult game I had was against Thomas because he brought an Abyssal Dwarf army that was all grotesque and half-breeds and regeneration and defense 5. And this army didn't have the ability to break through defense 5 regenerating. Not the way I was playing it. So that was probably the most challenging game. But I had some great games at that tournament. I'd probably make a few changes, probably add some more heavy warriors to the list or give some items to the longbowmen. Because what I found is I was quite happy to let them go into combat with melee 4+. And had I given them vicious or +1 strength, crushing strength, then they could perform in the close combats that they inevitably got into. So hopefully at Mountaineer I can pull them out again. I can add some additional warlord figures or Victrix or what have you to have that army ready again this year for Mountaineer to come take the field and do a rematch. But they ended well. It was a good tournament. I had fun. Played some great players. I got to play Tim Smith and Tony and all of them. So I really enjoyed that army. Like I said, it felt like the English army. You have your longbows in the center. You have your heavy warriors in between. You have your knights in the back. And then I kind of cheated with the Pegasus knights.
You know, I think the Mythical Allies, I think it's kind of a nice, as you said, a nice segue to kind of bridge the gap between historical and fantasy armies.
Absolutely. And in my Joan of Arc's list, I used an Earl Lohi, and then in another tournament I took them to, I used a whole horde of Lohi. So now I have this horde of Lohi that I'm working on. I have an Earl Lohi that I'm working on. I bought them from Mantic. So I have the beginnings of a Basilia army currently in the works, thanks to wanting to do a French list with Joan of Arc and her angels.
So you had a pretty good run, though. I mean, the English played pretty well, but something in the back of your mind said, no, I really like the French better than that. Is that what it was? but you're from the English area of Canada, not the French Canadian spot. So I'm a little confused why you would go from English to French.
Well, so I had the games at Mountaineer, and one of the issues I found was the reload on the longbowmen. So if you can't move and shoot, it's hard to play a scenario like Invade. It's hard to play Control. It's hard to get across the board and fight if you can't move and shoot, if you can't do what you need to do. So I played those games and I was like, man, you know what? Next time I'm going to play as the French and see if it makes any difference at all. And you're absolutely right. So if I ever go with my dad to a doubles tournament that allows historicals, we're going to bring the English and we're going to bring the French. And we're going to make a dice roll to see who plays which army. And then we're going to make fun of each other the entire time, because as Canadians, making fun of whether you're French-Canadian or English-Canadian is a completely appropriate activity, especially when it's done all in good fun with more than a couple of drinks downrange. So I had the experience with the English, and I'm like, you know what? I think the French have the absolute best heavy cavalry in the game, bar none. I think they're points efficient. I think it makes it feel the way the French feel. And I want to try Joan of Arc. Her special rule is amazing. She's a support character. She's not very strong in her own. She's just melee 4, defense 4, 2 attacks. But what she does is she's very inspiring. She's rally 2. And she gives fury to everyone within 6 inches of her. And I'm like, you know what? That kind of feels like Joan of Arc. I watched Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So I saw Bill and Ted go back in time, pick up Joan of Arc for their school project. And prior to going to Crucible, I bought myself a Wild Stallions t-shirt so I could fit the role of Bill and Ted and be in that mindset. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to bring 5 regiments of knights. And I'm going to just flood the field with these knights and give it a go and see if this works better for me. I'm not sure if it actually worked better for me because I think I ended up around 500 again. But it was again, a fun army to play. It was very different from the English. I will pull them out again in the future at some point in time. So the army was actually a unit of warriors, which is pretty standard, 4-4, 13-15. 2 units of heavy warriors, which I put all in a row. I would have my general and a musician behind that. And then I learned over the course of the tournament to keep a unit of knights behind that block. So those 3, 4, 5, 6 drops were my starting 6 drops in games 4 and 5 because that's my main battle line. And the reason why you have the knights behind is because eventually one of your units of warriors will get thumped and be taken off, but they're going to cause some damage in the meantime, which allows your knights to deliver the charge that French knights are known for. So that became my block that I developed over the course of the tournament. Speaking of which, probably would have been helpful to have played games before the tournament to learn this.
That's not just a historical thing. That's a all kind of game system thing.
Absolutely. Because in both tournaments, when I was pulling these armies out, both at Mountaineer and Crucible, it's the first time I'm pulling these armies out saying, I wonder how this will work. So it was drinking from a fire hose. But that would be my first block. My second block was 3 units of knights with a hero on winged beasts. And an Earl Ojai and Joan of Arc, because with 3 units of knights, 16 attacks, Thunderous Charge 2, Elite Headstrong, you can begin to use one as a chaff piece and have the other 2 be there to be like, okay, well, if you're going to hit this guy, you have to go through a 16-18 nerve because he's rallied. And he has Fury and Headstrong, and if you don't break that, you're going to get thumped by the other 2. So that was really my wing that I want to win with. And then I'd put my 5th unit of knights on the far right flank. So I have 18 drops in a 2250 list. I didn't actually have to show which side I was going to begin pushing on until about drop 14. And normally most people had finished deploying their army by that point in time. So it was a lot of fun. The army performed fairly well. There were monsters in it because there was a Halloween-themed event. So every game you got a different monster to use, which added another layer of complication. But I had a lot of fun with this list. And actually, the warriors and heavy warriors were an MVP that I didn't actually count on. I knew that the knights were good. I knew that the rules for them with elite and headstrong would make it so that they could hit well. But what I didn't count on was just how good the 3 regiments were, backed up by a regiment of knights, as a solid block to move forward, to take charges, and to secure the middle, to win the objective, to sit on it, to provide unit strength. And that was really my surprise with the French over the course of that tournament. So I don't know if I'd try to change it to get 2 hordes of heavy warriors or a horde of warriors. I'm thinking along that lines. I've also done a list where I've gotten rid of the winged heroes and the heroes on winged beasts, the Pegasus Knights and the Earl Ojai, to make almost a completely historical army. And I think the French can do it because they don't need the Bane Chant. In our one-day event at the start of Crucible, I think I went 1 for 7 or 1 for 8. Joey Greek could confirm the number for the number of 2-dice Bane Chants that worked. It was not very successful. And when you're hitting Varanger Mounted Sons with your knights, because you've got the charge off, you want it to work, and you want every advantage you can. And when the Bane Chant fails, your partner looks at you, because it's a doubles event, and goes, do you want me to roll the dice next time?
I could see Joey looking at you that way, too.
I got to play them 3 times at 1,000 points in the lead-up, and they were fun games, and Joey was great to play with, but my dice probably let us down a little bit. But the French are a fun army. And that's what I mean by you can play the French, you can play the English, you can play the Macedonians, you can play the Greeks. I'm looking at the Anglo-Saxons because their infantry has throwing weapons. So all of a sudden I have a horde of shield wall infantry with throwing weapons that can move and shoot and throw 25 dice. And I think that'd be something abnormal in Kings of War, but not necessarily broken. Because everyone knows, okay, it's a throwing weapon, range 12, and you only move 5. Good. But then I can pretend to be Alfred the Great and fight the Vikings. So he'll make me feel good. So I played the 5 games with the French at Crucible, and then I went to the last-minute tournament. And just to show that sometimes, no matter what you do, it just doesn't work. At every other tournament I've taken the historicals to, I've normally run about 500. Even in the one day with Joey, I think we won 1, lost 2. But this was an under-the-wire tournament. There were 10 players. It was the last tournament of the Mid-Atlantic season. And I ended up 10th for 10. And we had 2 brand new players there who had never played Kings of War before that day. And I still managed to come dead last.
That's unbelievable. I was going to say, well, obviously it was all 9 Masters players, but that's not the case.
No, I played Mike Atkins for my final game. I played George O'Connell for second. And I played, so I played 3 really good players and I got thumped. And so sometimes with the French, you're winning, and sometimes you're refighting the Battle of Crecy. And in that case, I was doing all the greatest hits of the English army, and I just wasn't playing the English army. The dice weren't with me, the scenarios. Loot was actually the scenario I found hardest with the French. I don't know why. I haven't figured that out yet, but I've played it 4 times now with this army, and I haven't won it once. So for anyone considering taking the French at any future tournaments, and I heard rumors that somebody's considering it for Masters, my suggestion is to try to figure out how loot works.
Why do you think that is? I mean, loot's a weird scenario to begin with, but what is it about the French army that you were... I mean, was it really loot, or was it more about the armies you were playing against in loot?
I think it was loot, because you don't want to pick up the token, because that stops your knights from moving.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to be charged, if at all possible, which is why I'm thinking maybe I have to buff my infantry element in the French army, is to win those scenarios, such as loot. Because I can't move my knights up to take the token and take a charge, because that kills a lot of the knights' momentum and capabilities. If I sit back, then I'm letting the opponent dictate how the matchups will go. And there's an element of aggression, an element of impetuousness that you just have to have if you're playing French. A certain je ne sais quoi, because you're French and that's the way it goes. And I couldn't arrange it. I couldn't make it work with loot. It was slightly frustrating. But any other scenario has worked for me. Push is fine. Invade is good. Control's fine. It's just, ironically, loot.
So let's just not play loot.
If given a choice, I will avoid that one in the future. Probably it's a game that the English could do well, but just not the French. The whole Canada divide thing. Part of us do well in one thing, part of us do well at a different thing.
So next, I guess you wanted to go over a little bit more over the French list itself.
As I mentioned, in all the armies, you have a key unit. You have a key unit that does special things that's available in that army and no others. So one of the ones I've heard people get excited for was the Scottish, because you have dismounted knights. And that's a special, unique thing for the Scottish. They're melee 3, they're defense 5, they have crushing strength 1, and fury for 160 points for a regiment. They're really good. Highlanders, they're crushing strength 2, and you get to paint a bunch of people with kilts. So I probably would never do that, but you could if you really wanted to. You also have William Wallace, who increases the thunderous charge by people within 6 inches by 1. So if you're building a Scottish list, I would have lots of Highlanders, the Dismounted Knights, and William Wallace, so I could have Crushing 2, Thunderous 1 when I charge in and yell freedom, because that's what I'd do if I was the Scottish. If you're the Holy Roman Empire, You have the vicious two-handed weapons, which give you crushing strength one, vicious, and ignore and snare. So every list has something that no one else has. The English have their longbows with piercing one, reload, elite, the melee 4+, the 250 points for a horde, so they're extremely expensive, but they do something that no one else does. They also have light lancers, which give you Pathfinder on a thunderous charge, one cavalry unit that moves 9. I didn't take them in my list. Maybe I should have. Probably something I'll look at in the future. And then you have the Black Prince, who has, I think, 5 attacks in Dread, and he goes forth, and he's a unique character. So if you're building an English list, you should take into account the special abilities, special characteristics of the English, which I guess goes back to your historical. Do you have to build a historical army? No. Are you encouraged to build a historical army? Yes. You're encouraged because those units are kind of unique and no one else has them. And that's why you're playing in the army, is you want to play with a slightly unique list. So with my French, I built it around Joan of Arc and the cavalry units, the Chevalier. Why? Because for 200 points, you get a 14-16 block of knights with elite, headstrong, and thunderous too. I could take those, mash them up with Joan of Arc, so you're not only headstrong, but you have fury. You have rally 2 to be 16-18. And that's a solid punch unit. And you could have the Genoese crossbowmen, and in the future I'd probably look at those, because then you can have the Folklorn 2, which means that you're defense of 6 against shooting and defense 4 in close combat. So that's probably something I'd consider taking in the future instead of my winged beast, to give me a bit more of a melee line, a combat line, while my knights go forth and do their business. The knights were what I drew me to Joan of Arc. I used my Bretonian knights that I had from 7th and 8th edition Warhammer Fantasy. I'm currently in the process of buying historical 28mm knights because, unfortunately, my mom 25 years ago didn't have the foresight to buy me 28mm historicals. I got 15mm historicals, and I got to use them for DBA and DBM in the years in between. So I'm now currently going through and buying a 28mm 100 Years War Army, both English and French, so I can bring them to future tournaments and events. And eventually I'll get around to painting them.
What model range are you using?
At this point in time, I'm using a combination of Warlord Games, Perry Brothers, and I'm looking at what set of knights I want to use to get late 1300s armor. So not quite full plate that you think of when you see the movie Excalibur and the covered head to toe in armor. So I want basically plate mail for the breastplate and some chain mail, so the combination. And I have them in the closet right now. It's just I haven't pulled them out to paint.
When are we going to see them all on the table?
I think that'll be after the Forces of Abyss and probably after the Anglo-Saxons and Normans. And when I'm not listening to Countercharge and the Kings of War podcast, I listen to books on tape through Audible. And one of the books I just finished listening to was The Norman Invasion of England in 1066. And until then, I had no idea just how conflicted that period of time was, with all the invasions of England going from basically 950 to 1070, 1080, with the Anglo-Saxons fighting almost every year against the Normans, against the Vikings, against the Picts, against the Scottish, and hearing that and hearing essentially Game of Thrones, because mm-hmm. people might think that the Red Wedding is something that George R. R. Martin came up with. No, it happened at least 4 times during that period, where Anglo-Saxons of one house would invite another house and then kill them over a wedding feast. So that got me excited to do an Anglo-Saxon and Norman army and refight Hastings. So I don't know when, probably over the course of the next year, I'll have another historical army done up. But in the meantime, I'm going to try to make my French army and English army a bit smoother and a bit more cohesive, probably multi-base them in time for Mountaineer. I will have a historical army out at Mountaineer, assuming that Chris Fisher lets me bring one again.
I'm sure Chris is a good guy. He knows all the army lists very well. He doesn't have a problem.
And he let me bring it last year, and there were no issues, so I can't see an issue this year.
Well, great. Maybe we'll get to play.
Absolutely. You're coming out to Mountaineer?
Yeah, we will be there.
Look forward to seeing you there.
Kind of put a capstone on the historical book, kind of your takeaways, if you will.
So my takeaway is that I would recommend that everyone get the Kings of War historical book. It provides an excellent copy of rules, which you can use with your friends who have historical miniatures. You can adjust the scale to whatever models they have. If you know Kings of War, you know the historical rules. There's not many changes. You get to play all the different periods of history. You can pretend to be the Egyptians with Ramses II, or you could pretend to be the conquistadors invading the New World. So whatever period of time, it's what you've come to expect and love from Mantic, a solid, slick set of rules which work the system, and you don't have to work a lot to play the game, and you can just enjoy the experience of having your models on the table, acting in a historical manner, and getting a really good game out of the deal.
That's well said.
In the future, my closing comments is I'd just like to encourage organizers to allow historical armies into the tournaments. To the best of my knowledge, they're not winning best overall across the GTs, and they're not overpowered. If you want to put an asterisk next to the Huns and Mongols, do so, but every other army should be, you should have no issues at all incorporating them into your tournaments, and they allow for new players coming from the historical community to see the fun that we can have in this great Kings of War fantasy community.
You know, I don't see the historical book any different than like Destiny of Kings. I think every supplement's going to have some things that maybe weren't thought out through well enough. And, you know, just like all the supplements, you know, let everything in. Why not?
So Rob, so what do I have to do to convince you to allow the English and French to Blue City Brawl?
Well, you got to sign up first.
That's
but
fair.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, you know, in really the only, I don't want to say negative, the only reason why we haven't is just so that we try to limit all the variables. So we don't let any of the books in. It's literally just vanilla Kings of War. So there's no Destiny of Kings. There's no nothing. There's just the Kings of War supplement and Uncharted Empires. But you make a pretty convincing argument that really, why not? Why not let them in? It's not the end of the world. You know, in fact, you could argue that they are a little underpowered, right? And so, really, you're not, you know, I guess I'm scared about what happened, you know, when Jeff Swan thinks about it and he starts thinking about in a doubles format, putting a historical army with a fantasy army and figures out a way to break it. That's something I need to think about. Is there an option? Is there an opportunity for a really terrible combination that we have not seen before?
I guess my only comment is Joey Greek was playing Salamanders and I was playing French, and we went 1-for-3 in the doubles tournament on the opening day of Crucible. So,
well, that's Joey's fault. I'm assuming.
So, you know, you probably could come up with an evil combination of Mongols with elves. And not to say that it's not possible to break it, but I'm sure somebody could come up with an evil combination of two different races in Kings of War as well. So I would say the tournament organizer always has the right to review your army and say, if you're going to bring a historical list, please message me first so that we can.
Well, Ray, I appreciate you coming on, chatting about historical.
Thank armies. You very much that's for having me.
Yeah, as I said at the top, we don't talk about historicals enough. They kind of came out with not a lot of fanfare. We did a review of the book, and it kind of came and went. And I think we've missed an opportunity to really bring in. This is sort of that bridge to bring in some of those old time historical gamers into our game system, cross them over to fantasy or cross us back over the bridge to historical. And it's a bridge that's there and we don't make use of it as much as we should.
Well, I'd like to give a shout out to Cody who ran Crucible. Thank you very much for a wonderful tournament. And to Chris who ran Mountaineer for allowing me to bring the English out to that. I greatly appreciate both of your efforts in running the tournament. Actually, all the people who've run tournaments, it's a lot of work. And Ryan down in the States at Alamo, I guess I'm in the States too, but to all of you guys who run the tournaments, thank you very much for your effort. Looking forward to future tournaments with Robert at Siege and Mike at Vanguard, and of course, Masters. Thank you very much for all your work that you do to allow us to enjoy this game, to hang out with a great group of friends, and have an awesome time.
We're blessed with a extravagant amount of riches in terms of terrific people that are running some wonderful events around the country, from the West Coast to the East Coast to Duluth, Minnesota, all the way down to, you know, Orlando, Florida. So, well, Ray, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's going to do us tonight. And until next time, keep countercharging.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by posting on our episode thread on the discussion forum found on manticgames.com. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.